in a tunnel under the U.S. Capitol. Faulkman sensed from Langdon's voice that he was not joking. What is it with this guy? Robert, why can't you just stay home and write? His computer pinged. Okay, hold on. I got it. He moused through the old email thread. It looks like all I have is her cell. I'll take it. Faulkman gave him the number. Thanks, Jonas, Langdon said, sounding grateful. I owe you one. You owe me a manuscript, Robert. Do you have any idea how long... The line went dead. Faulkman stared at the receiver and shook his head. Book publishing would be so much easier without the authors. Chapter 45. Catherine Solomon did a double take when she saw the name on her caller ID. She had imagined the incoming call was from Trish, checking in to explain why she and Christopher Abaddon were taking so long. But the caller was not Trish. Far from it. Catherine felt a blushing smile cross her lips. Could tonight get any stranger? She flipped open her phone. Don't tell me, she said playfully. Bookish bachelor seeking single noetic scientist? Catherine! The deep voice belonged to Robert Langdon. Thank God you're okay. Of course I'm okay, she replied, puzzled. Other than the fact that you never called me after that party at Peter's house last summer. Something has happened tonight. Please listen. His normally smooth voice sounded ragged. I'm so sorry to have to tell you this, but Peter is in serious trouble. Catherine's smile disappeared. What are you talking about? Peter... Langdon hesitated, as if searching for words. I don't know how to say it, but he's been... taken. I'm not sure how or by whom, but...
Taken?
Catherine demanded. Robert, you're scaring me. Taken where? Taken captive. Langdon's voice cracked as if he were overwhelmed. It must have happened earlier today or maybe yesterday. This isn't funny, she said angrily. My brother is fine. I just spoke to him 15 minutes ago. You did? Langdon sounded stunned.
Yes. He just texted me to say he was coming to the lab.
He texted you, Langdon thought out loud. But you didn't actually hear his voice.
No, but
listen to me. The text you received was not from your brother. Someone has Peter's phone. He's dangerous. Whoever it is tricked me into coming to Washington tonight.
Tricked you? You're not making any sense.
I know, I'm so sorry. Langdon seemed uncharacteristically disoriented. Catherine, I think you could be in danger. Catherine Solomon was sure that Langdon would never joke about something like this, and yet he sounded like he had lost his mind.
I'm fine, she said. I'm locked inside a secure building.
Read me the message you got from Peter's phone, please. Bewildered, Catherine pulled up the text message and read it to Langdon, feeling a chill as she came to the final part referencing Dr. Abaddon.
If available, have Dr. Abaddon join us inside. I trust him fully.
Oh, God. Langdon's voice was laced with fear. Did you invite this man inside?
Yes. My assistant just went out to the lobby to get him. I expect them back any-
Catherine, get out! Langdon yelled. Now! At the other side of the SMSC inside the security room, a phone began ringing, drowning out the Redskins game. The guard reluctantly pulled out his earbuds one more time. Lobby, he answered. This is Kyle.
Kyle, it's Catherine Solomon.
Her voice sounded anxious, out of breath. Ma'am, your brother has not yet-
Where's Trish? She demanded. Can you see her on the monitors?
The guard rolled his chair over to look at the screens. She hasn't gotten back to the cube yet?
No!
Catherine shouted, sounding alarmed. The guard now realized that Catherine Solomon was out of breath, as if she were running. What's going on back there? The guard quickly worked the video joystick, skimming through frames of digital video at rapid speed.
Okay, hold on. Scrolling through playback. I've got Trish with your guest leaving the lobby. They move down the street. Fast-forwarding.
Okay. They're going into wet pod.
Trish uses her keycard to unlock the door. Both of them step into wet pod. Fast-forwarding. Okay, here they are coming out of wet pod just a minute ago. Heading down...
He cocked his head, slowing the playback. Wait a minute. That's odd.
What?
The gentleman came out of wet pod alone.
Trish stayed inside?
Yes, it looks that way. I'm watching your guest now. He's in the hall on his own.
Where is Trish?
Catherine asked more frantically. I don't see her on the video feed, he replied, an edge of anxiety creeping into his voice. He looked back at the screen and noticed that the man's jacket sleeves appeared to be wet, all the way up to his elbows. What in the world did he do in Wet Pod? The guard watched as the man began to move purposefully down the main hallway toward Pod 5, clutching in his hand what looked like a key card. The guard felt the hair on the back of his neck stand on end. Miss Solomon, we've got a serious problem. Tonight was a night of firsts for Catherine Solomon. In 2 years, she had never used her cell phone inside the void, nor had she ever crossed the void at a dead run. At the moment, however, Catherine had a cell phone pressed to her ear while she was dashing blindly along the endless length of carpet. Each time she felt a foot stray from the carpet, she corrected back to center, racing on through the sheer darkness.
Where is he now?
Catherine asked the guard, breathless. Checking now, the guard replied. Fast-forwarding. Okay, here he is walking down the hall, moving toward Pod 5. Catherine ran harder, hoping to reach the exit before she got trapped back here.
How long until he gets to the Pod 5 entrance?
The guard paused. Ma'am, you don't understand. I'm still fast-forwarding. This is recorded playback. This already happened. He paused. Hold on, let me check the entry event monitor. He paused and then said, Ma'am? Ms. Dunn's key card shows a Pod 5 entry event about a minute ago. Catherine slammed on the brakes, sliding to a halt in the middle of the abyss.
He already unlocked Pod 5?
She whispered into the phone. The guard was typing frantically.
Yes, it looks like he entered 90 seconds ago.
Catherine's body went rigid. She stopped breathing. The darkness felt suddenly alive all around her.
He's in here with me.
In an instant, Catherine realized that the only light in the entire space was coming from her cell phone, illuminating the side of her face.
Send help, she whispered to the guard, and get to Wet Pod to help Trish.
Then she quietly closed her phone, extinguishing the light. Absolute darkness settled around her. She stood stock still and breathed as quietly as possible. After a few seconds, the pungent scent of ethanol wafted out of the darkness in front of her. The smell got stronger. She could sense a presence only a few feet in front of her on the carpet. In the silence, the pounding of Catherine's heart seemed loud enough to give her away. Silently, she stepped out of her shoes and inched to her left, sidestepping off the carpet. The cement felt cold under her feet. She took one more step to clear the carpet. One of her toes cracked. It sounded like a gunshot in the stillness. Only a few yards away, a rustle of clothing suddenly came at her out of the darkness. Catherine bolted an instant too late, and a powerful arm snagged her, groping in the darkness, hands violently attempting to gain purchase. She spun away as a vice-like grip caught her lab coat, yanking her backward, reeling her in. Catherine threw her arms backward, slithering out of her lab coat and slipping free. Suddenly, with no idea any more which way was out, Catherine Solomon found herself dashing, dead blind, across an endless black abyss. Chapter 46. Despite containing what many have called the most beautiful room in the world, the Library of Congress is known less for its breathtaking splendor than for its vast collections. With over 500 miles of shelves, enough to stretch from Washington, D.C. to Boston, it easily claims the title of largest library on earth. And yet still, it expands at a rate of over 10,000 items per day. As an early repository for Thomas Jefferson's personal collection of books on science and philosophy, the library stood as a symbol of America's commitment to the dissemination of knowledge. One of the first buildings in Washington to have electric lights, it literally shone like a beacon in the darkness of the New World. As its name implies, the Library of Congress was established to serve Congress, whose venerated members worked across the street in the Capitol building. This age-old bond between library and Capitol had been fortified recently by the construction of a physical connection, a long tunnel beneath Independence Avenue that linked the two buildings. Tonight, inside this dimly lit tunnel, Robert Langdon followed Warren Bellamy through a construction zone, trying to quell his own deepening concern for Catherine. This lunatic is at her lab? Langdon didn't even want to imagine why. When he had called to warn her, Langdon had told Catherine exactly where to meet him before they hung up.
How much longer is this damned tunnel?
His head ached now, a roiling torrent of interconnected thoughts. Catherine, Peter, the Masons, Bellamy, pyramids, ancient prophecy, and a map. Langdon shook it all off and pressed on. Bellamy promised me answers. When the two men finally reached the end of the passage, Bellamy guided Langdon through a set of double doors that were still under construction. Finding no way to lock the unfinished doors behind them, Bellamy improvised, grabbing an aluminum ladder from the construction supplies and leaning it precariously against the outside of the door. Then he balanced a metal bucket on top. If anyone opened the door, the bucket would crash loudly to the floor.
That's our alarm system?
Langdon eyed the perched bucket, hoping Bellamy had a more comprehensive plan for their safety tonight. Everything had happened so fast, and Langdon was only now starting to process the repercussions of his fleeing with Bellamy.
I'm a fugitive from the CIA.
Bellamy led the way around a corner where the two men began ascending a wide staircase that was cordoned off with orange pylons. Langdon's day bag weighed him down as he climbed.
The stone pyramid, he said. I still don't understand.
Not here, Bellamy interrupted. We'll examine it in the light. I know a safe place.
Langdon doubted such a place existed for anyone who had just physically assaulted the director of the CIA's Office of Security. As the two men reached the top of the stairs, they entered a wide hallway of Italian marble, stucco, and gold leaf. The hall was lined with 8 pairs of statues, all depicting the goddess Minerva. Bellamy pressed on, leading Langdon eastward through a vaulted archway into a far grander space. Even in the dim after-hours lighting, the library's great hall shone with the classical grandeur of an opulent European palace. 75 feet overhead, stained glass skylights glistened between paneled beams adorned with rare aluminum leaf, a metal that was considered to be more precious than gold at one time. Beneath that, a stately course of paired pillars lined the second-floor balcony, accessible by 2 magnificent curling staircases whose newel posts supported giant bronze female figures raising torches of enlightenment. In a bizarre attempt to reflect this theme of modern enlightenment and yet stay within the decorative register of Renaissance architecture, the stairway banisters had been carved with Cupid-like putti, portrayed as modern scientists. An angelic electrician holding a telephone? A cherubic entomologist with a specimen box? Langdon wondered what Bernini would have thought.
We'll talk over here, Bellamy said,
leading Langdon past the bulletproof display cases that contained the library's 2 most valuable books, the Giant Bible of Mainz, handwritten in the 1450s, and America's copy of the Gutenberg Bible, one of only 3 perfect vellum copies in the world. Fittingly, the vaulted ceiling overhead bore John White Alexander's 6-panel painting titled The Evolution of the Book. Bellamy strode directly to a pair of elegant double doors at the center rear of the east corridor wall. Langdon knew what room lay beyond those doors, but it seemed a strange choice for a conversation. Notwithstanding the irony of talking in a space filled with silence please signs, this room hardly seemed like a safe place. Located dead center of the library's cruciform-shaped floor plan, this chamber served as the heart of the building. Hiding in here was like breaking into a cathedral and hiding on the altar. Nonetheless, Bellamy unlocked the doors, stepped into the darkness beyond, and groped for the lights. When he flipped the switch, one of America's great architectural masterpieces seemed to materialize out of thin air. The famous reading room was a feast for the senses. A voluminous octagon rose 160 feet at its center. Its 8 sides, finished in chocolate-brown Tennessee marble, cream-colored Siena marble, and apple-red Algerian marble. Because it was lit from 8 angles, no shadows fell anywhere, creating the effect that the room itself was glowing.
Some say it's the most striking room in Washington, Bellamy said, ushering Langdon inside.
Maybe in the whole world, Langdon thought, as he stepped across the threshold. As always, his gaze first ascended straight up to the towering central collar, where rays of arabesque coffers curled down the dome to an upper balcony. Encircling the room, 16 bronze portrait statues peered down from the balustrade. Beneath them, a stunning arcade of archways formed a lower balcony. Down at floor level, Three concentric circles of burnished wood desks radiated out from the massive octagonal circulation desk. Langdon returned his focus to Bellamy, who was now propping the room's double doors wide open.
"I thought we were hiding," Langdon said, confused. "If anyone enters the building," Bellamy said, "I want to hear them coming."
"But won't they find us instantly in here?"
"No matter where we hide, they'll find us. But if anyone corners us in this building, you'll be very glad I chose this room."
Langdon had no idea why, but Bellamy apparently wasn't looking to discuss it. He was already on the move toward the center of the room, where he selected one of the available reading desks, pulled up two chairs, and flipped on the reading light. Then he motioned to Langdon's bag.
"Okay, Professor. Let's have a closer look."
Not wanting to risk scratching its polished surface with a rough piece of granite, Langdon hoisted his entire bag onto the desk and unzipped it, folding the sides all the way down to reveal the pyramid inside. Warren Bellamy adjusted the reading lamp and studied the pyramid carefully. He ran his fingers over the unusual engraving.
"I assume you recognize this language?" Bellamy asked.
"Of course," Langdon replied, eyeing the 16 symbols. Known as the Freemason's Cipher, this encoded language had been used for private communication among early Masonic brothers. The encryption method had been abandoned long ago for one simple reason. It was much too easy to break. Most of the students in Langdon's senior symbology seminar could break this code in about 5 minutes. Langdon, with a pencil and paper, could do it in under 60 seconds. The notorious breakability of this centuries-old encryption scheme now presented a couple of paradoxes. First, the claim that Langdon was the only person on Earth who could break it was absurd. Second, for Sato to suggest that a Masonic cipher was an issue of national security was like her suggesting our nuclear launch codes were encrypted with a crackerjack decoder ring. Langdon was still struggling to believe any of it. "This pyramid is a map? Pointing to the lost wisdom of the ages?"
"Robert," Bellamy said, his tone grave, "did Director Sato tell you why she is so interested in this?"
Langdon shook his head. "Not specifically. She just kept saying it was an issue of national security. I assume she's lying."
"Perhaps," Bellamy said, rubbing the back of his neck.
He seemed to be struggling with something.
"But there's a far more troubling possibility."
He turned to look Langdon in the eye.
"It's possible that Director Sato has discovered this pyramid's true potential."
Chapter 47. The blackness engulfing Catherine Solomon felt absolute. Having fled the familiar safety of the carpet, she was now groping blindly forward, her outstretched hands touching only empty space as she staggered deeper into the desolate void. Beneath her stockinged feet, the endless expanse of cold cement felt like a frozen lake, a hostile environment from which she now needed to escape. No longer smelling ethanol, she stopped and waited in darkness. Standing dead still, she listened, willing her heart to stop pounding so loudly. The heavy footsteps behind her seemed to have stopped.
"Did I lose him?"
Catherine closed her eyes and tried to imagine where she was.
"Which direction did I run? Where's the door?"
It was no use. She was so turned around now that the exit could be anywhere. Fear, Catherine had once heard, acted as a stimulant, sharpening the mind's ability to think. Right now, however, her fear had turned her mind into a tumbling torrent of panic and confusion.
"Even if I find the exit, I can't get out."
Her keycard had been lost when she'd shed her lab coat. Her only hope seemed to be that she was now a needle in a haystack, a single point on a 30,000-square-foot grid. Despite the overwhelming urge to flee, Catherine's analytical mind told her instead to make the only logical move. No move at all.
"Stay still. Don't make a sound."
The security guard was on his way, and for some unknown reason, her attacker smelled strongly of ethanol.
"If he gets too close, I'll know it."
As Catherine stood in silence, her mind raced over what Langdon had said. "Your brother. He's been taken." She felt a bead of cold sweat materialize on her arm and trickle down toward the cell phone still clenched in her right hand. It was a danger she had forgotten to consider. If the phone rang, it would give away her position, and she could not turn it off without opening it and illuminating the display. set down the phone, and move away from it. But it was too late. The smell of ethanol approached on her right, and now it grew stronger. Catherine struggled to stay calm, forcing herself to override the instinct to run. Carefully, slowly, she took one step to her left. The faint rustle of her clothing was apparently all her attacker needed. She heard him lunge, and the smell of ethanol washed over her as a powerful hand grabbed at her shoulder. She twisted away, raw terror gripping her. Mathematical probability went out the window, and Catherine broke into a blind sprint. She veered hard to the left, changing course, dashing blindly now into the void. The wall materialized out of nowhere. Catherine hit it hard, knocking the wind from her lungs. Pain blossomed in her arm and shoulder, but she managed to stay on her feet. The oblique angle at which she had collided with the wall had spared her the full force of the blow, but it was little comfort now. The sound had echoed everywhere. "He knows where I am." Doubled over in pain, she turned her head and stared out into the blackness of the pod, and sensed him staring back at her.
"Change your location, now."
Still struggling to catch her breath, she began moving down the wall, touching her left hand quietly to each exposed steel stud as she passed.
"Stay along the wall. Slip past him before he corners you."
In her right hand, Catherine still clutched her cell phone, ready to hurl it as a projectile if need be. Catherine was in no way prepared for the sound she heard next, the clear rustle of clothing directly in front of her, against the wall. She froze, stock still, and stopped breathing.
"How could he be on the wall already?"
She felt a faint puff of air laced with the stench of ethanol.
"He's moving down the wall toward me."
Catherine backed up several steps. Then, turning silently 180 degrees, she began moving quickly in the opposite direction down the wall. She moved 20 feet or so when the impossible happened. Once again, directly in front of her along the wall, she heard the rustling sound of clothing. Then came the same puff of air and the smell of ethanol. Catherine Solomon froze in place.
"My God, he's everywhere."
Bare-chested, Malak stared into the darkness. The smell of ethanol on his sleeves had proven a liability, and so he had transformed it into an asset, stripping off his shirt and jacket, and using them to help corner his prey. Throwing his jacket against the wall to the right, he had heard Catherine stop short and change direction. Now, having thrown his shirt ahead to the left, Malak had heard her stop again. He had effectively corralled Catherine against the wall by establishing points beyond which she dared not pass. Now he waited, ears straining in the silence.
"She has only one direction she can move. Directly toward me."
Even so, Malak heard nothing. Either Catherine was paralyzed with fear, or she had decided to stand still and wait for help to enter Pod 5.
Either way, she loses.
Nobody would be entering Pod 5 anytime soon. Malak had disabled the outer keypad with a very crude, yet very effective technique. After using Trish's keycard, he had rammed a single dime deep into the keycard slot to prevent any other keycard use without first dismantling the entire mechanism.
"You and I are alone, Catherine, for as long as this takes."
Malak inched silently forward, listening for any movement. Catherine Solomon would die tonight in the darkness of her brother's museum. A poetic end. Malak looked forward to sharing the news of Catherine's death with her brother. The old man's anguish would be long-awaited revenge. Suddenly, in the darkness, to Malak's great surprise, he saw a tiny glow in the distance and realized Catherine had just made a deadly error in judgment.
"She's phoning for help."
The electronic display that had just flickered to life was hovering waist-high about 20 yards ahead, like a shining beacon on a vast ocean of black. Malak had been prepared to wait Catherine out, but now he wouldn't have to. Malak sprang into motion, racing toward the hovering light, knowing he had to reach her before she could complete her call for help. He was there in a matter of seconds, and he lunged, arms outstretched on either side of her glowing cell phone, preparing to engulf her. Malak's fingers jammed into a solid wall, bending backward and almost breaking. His head collided next, crashing into a steel beam. He cried out in pain as he crumpled beside the wall. Cursing, he clambered back to his feet, pulling himself up by the waist-high horizontal strut on which Catherine Solomon had cleverly placed her open cell phone. Catherine was running again, this time with no concern for the noise her hand was making as it bounced rhythmically off the evenly spaced metal studs of Pod 5.
Run!
If she followed the wall all the way around the pod, she knew that sooner or later she would feel the exit door.
Where the hell is the guard?
The even spacing of the studs continued as she ran with her left hand on the sidewall and her right out in front of her for protection.
When will I reach the corner?
The sidewall seemed to go on and on, but suddenly the rhythm of the studs was broken. Her left hand hit empty space for several long strides, and then the studs began again. Catherine slammed on the brakes and backed up, feeling her way across the smooth metal panel.
Why are there no studs here?
She could hear her attacker lumbering loudly after her now, groping his way down the wall in her direction. Even so, it was a different sound that scared Catherine even more. The distant rhythmic banging of a security guard pounding his flashlight against the Pod 5 door.
The guard can't get in?
While the thought was terrifying, the location of his banging, diagonally to her right, instantly oriented Catherine. She could now picture where in Pod 5 she was located. The visual flash brought with it an unexpected realization. She now knew what this flat panel on the wall was. Every pod was equipped with a specimen bay, a giant movable wall that could be retracted for transporting oversized specimens in and out of the pods. Like those of an airplane hangar, this door was mammoth, and Catherine in her wildest dreams had never imagined needing to open it. At the moment, though, it seemed like her only hope.
Is it even operable?
Catherine fumbled blindly in the blackness, searching the bay door until she found the large metal handle. Grasping it, she threw her weight backward, trying to slide open the door.
Nothing.
She tried again.
It didn't budge.
She could hear her attacker closing faster now, homing in on the sounds of her efforts.
The bay door's locked.
Wild with panic, she slid her hands all over the door, feeling the surface for any latch or lever. She suddenly hit what felt like a vertical pole. She followed it down to the floor, crouching, and could feel it was inserted into a hole in the cement.
A security rod.
She stood up, grabbed the pole, and, lifting with her legs, slid the rod up and out of the hole.
He's almost here.
Catherine groped now for the handle, found it again, and heaved back on it with all her might. The massive panel seemed barely to move, and yet a sliver of moonlight now sliced into Pod 5. Catherine pulled again. The shaft of light from outside the building grew wider.
A little more.
She pulled one last time, sensing her attacker was now only a few feet away. Leaping toward the light, Catherine wriggled her slender body sideways into the opening. A hand materialized in the darkness, clawing at her, trying to pull her back inside. She heaved herself through the opening, pursued by a massive bare arm that was covered with tattooed scales. The terrifying arm writhed like an angry snake trying to seize her. Catherine spun and fled down the long, pale outer wall of Pod 5. The bed of loose stones that surrounded the entire perimeter of the SMSC cut into her stockinged feet as she ran, but she pressed on, heading for the main entrance. The night was dark, but with her eyes fully dilated from the utter blackness of Pod 5, she could see perfectly, almost as if it were daylight. Behind her, the heavy bay door ground open, and she heard heavy footsteps accelerating in pursuit down the side of the building. The footsteps seemed impossibly fast.
I'll never outrun him to the main entrance.
She knew her Volvo was closer, but even that would be too far.
I'm not going to make it.
Then Catherine realized she had one final card to play. As she neared the corner of Pod 5, she could hear his footsteps quickly overtaking her in the darkness.
Now or never.
Instead of rounding the corner, Catherine suddenly cut hard to her left, away from the building, out onto the grass. As she did so, she closed her eyes tightly, placed both hands over her face, and began running totally blind across the lawn. The motion-activated security lighting that blazed to life around Pod 5 transformed night into day instantly. Catherine heard a scream of pain behind her as the brilliant floodlights seared into her assailant's hyperdilated pupils with over 25 million candle power of light. She could hear him stumbling on the loose stones. Catherine kept her eyes tightly closed, trusting herself on the open lawn. When she sensed she was far enough away from the building and the lights, she opened her eyes, corrected her course, and ran like hell through the dark. Her Volvo's keys were exactly where she always left them, in the center console. Breathless, she seized the keys in her trembling hands and found the ignition. The engine roared to life, and her headlights flipped on, illuminating a terrifying sight. A hideous form raced toward her. Catherine froze for an instant. The creature caught in her headlights was a bald and bare-chested animal, its skin covered with tattooed scales, symbols, and text. He bellowed as he ran into the glare, raising his hands before his eyes like a cave-dwelling beast seeing sunlight for the first time. She reached for the gear shift, but suddenly he was there, hurling his elbow through her side window, sending a shower of safety glass into her lap. A massive scale-covered arm burst through her window, groping half-blind, finding her neck. She threw the car in reverse, but her attacker had latched onto her throat, squeezing with unimaginable force. She turned her head in an attempt to escape his grasp, and suddenly she was staring at his face. Three dark stripes, like fingernail scratches, had torn through his face makeup to reveal the tattoos beneath. His eyes were wild and ruthless.
"I should have killed you 10 years ago," he growled. "The night I killed your mother."
As his words registered, Catherine was seized by a horrifying memory. That feral look in his eyes. She had seen it before.
It's him. She would have screamed, had it not been for the vice-like grip around her neck.
She smashed her foot onto the accelerator, and the car lurched backward, almost snapping her neck as he was dragged beside her car. The Volvo careened up an inclined median, and Catherine could feel her neck about to give way beneath his weight. Suddenly, tree branches were scraping the side of her car, slapping through the side windows, and the weight was gone. The car burst through the evergreens and out into the upper parking lot, where Catherine slammed on the brakes. Below her, the half-naked man clambered to his feet, staring into her headlights. With a terrifying calm, he raised a menacing scale-covered arm and pointed directly at her. Catherine's blood coursed with raw fear and hatred as she spun the wheel and hit the gas. Seconds later, she was fishtailing out onto Silver Hill Road. Chapter 48. In the heat of the moment, Capitol Police Officer Nunez had seen no option but to help the Capitol architect and Robert Langdon escape. Now, however, back in the basement police headquarters, Nunez could see the storm clouds gathering fast. Chief Trent Anderson was holding an ice pack to his head while another officer was tending to Sato's bruises. Both of them were standing with the video surveillance team, reviewing digital playback files in an attempt to locate Langdon and Bellamy.
"Check the playback on every hallway and exit," Sato demanded. "I want to know where they went."
Nunez felt ill as he looked on. He knew it would only be a matter of minutes before they found the right video clip and learned the truth. I helped them escape. Making matters worse was the arrival of a 4-man CIA field team that was now staging nearby, prepping to go after Langdon and Bellamy. These guys looked nothing like the Capitol Police. These guys were dead serious soldiers, black camouflage, night vision, futuristic-looking handguns. Nunez felt like he would throw up. Making up his mind, he motioned discreetly to Chief Anderson.
"A word, Chief?"
"What is it?"
Anderson followed Nunez into the hall.
"Chief, I made a bad mistake," Nunez said, breaking a sweat. "I'm sorry, and I'm resigning."
"You'll fire me in a few minutes anyway."
"I beg your pardon?"
Nunez swallowed hard.
"Earlier, I saw Langdon and Architect Bellamy in the visitor center, on their way out of the building."
"What?"
Anderson bellowed.
"Why didn't you say something?"
"The architect told me not to say a word."
"You work for me, goddammit."
Anderson's voice echoed down the corridor.
"Bellamy smashed my head into a wall, for Christ's sake."
Nunez handed Anderson the key that the architect had given him.
"What's this?"
Anderson demanded.
"A key to the new tunnel under Independence Avenue. Architect Bellamy had it. That's how they escaped."
Anderson stared down at the key, speechless. Sato poked her head out into the hallway, eyes probing.
"What's going on out here?"
Nunez felt himself go pale. Anderson was still holding the key, and Sato clearly had seen it. As the hideous little woman drew near, Nunez improvised as best he could, hoping to protect his chief.
"I found a key on the floor in the sub-basement. I was just asking Chief Anderson if he knew what it might go to."
Sato arrived, eyeing the key.
And does the chief know?
Nunez glanced up at Anderson, who was clearly weighing all his options before speaking. Finally, the chief shook his head.
Not offhand. I'd have to check the...
Don't bother,
Sato said.
This key unlocks a tunnel off the visitor center.
Really?
Anderson said.
How do you know that?
We just found the surveillance clip. Officer Nunez here helped Langdon and Bellamy escape, and then relocked that tunnel door behind them. Bellamy gave Nunez that key.
Anderson turned to Nunez with a flare of anger.
Is this true?
Nunez nodded vigorously, doing his best to play along.
I'm sorry, sir. The architect told me not to tell a soul.
I don't give a damn what the architect told you,
Anderson yelled.
I expect...
Shut up, Trent,
Sato snapped.
You're both lousy liars. Save it for your CIA inquisition.
She snatched the architect's tunnel key from Anderson.
You're done here.
Chapter 49. Robert Langdon hung up his cell phone, feeling increasingly worried. Catherine's not answering her cell. Catherine had promised to call him as soon as she was safely out of the lab and on her way to meet him here, but she had never done so. Bellamy sat beside Langdon at the reading room desk. He, too, had just made a call, his to an individual he claimed could offer them sanctuary, a safe place to hide. Unfortunately, this person was not answering either, and so Bellamy had left an urgent message, telling him to call Langdon's cell phone right away.
I'll keep trying, he said to Langdon, but for the moment we're on our own, and we need to discuss a plan for this pyramid.
The pyramid. For Langdon, the spectacular backdrop of the reading room had all but disappeared, his world constricting now to include only what was directly in front of him. A stone pyramid, a sealed package containing a capstone, and an elegant African-American man who had materialized out of the darkness and rescued him from the certainty of a CIA interrogation. Langdon had expected a modicum of sanity from the architect of the Capitol, but now it seemed Warren Bellamy was no more rational than the madman claiming Peter was in purgatory. Bellamy was insisting this stone pyramid was, in fact, the Masonic Pyramid of Legend. An ancient map that guides us to powerful wisdom?
Mr. Bellamy, Langdon said politely, this idea that there exists some kind of ancient knowledge that can imbue men with great power, I simply can't take it seriously.
Bellamy's eyes looked both disappointed and earnest, making Langdon's skepticism all the more awkward.
Yes, Professor. I had imagined you might feel this way. But I suppose I should not be surprised. You are an outsider looking in. There exist certain Masonic realities that you will perceive as myth because you are not properly initiated and prepared to understand them.
Now Langdon felt patronized. I wasn't a member of Odysseus's crew, but I'm certain the Cyclops is a myth. Mr. Bellamy, even if the legend is true, this pyramid cannot possibly be the Masonic pyramid.
No.
Bellamy ran a finger across the Masonic cipher on the stone.
It looks to me like it fits the description perfectly. A stone pyramid with a shining metal capstone, which, according to Sato's X-ray, is exactly what Peter entrusted to you.
Bellamy picked up the little cube-shaped package, weighing it in his hand.
This stone pyramid is less than a foot tall, Langdon countered. Every version of the story I've ever heard describes the Masonic pyramid as enormous.
Bellamy had clearly anticipated this point.
As you know, the legend speaks of a pyramid rising so high that God himself can reach out and touch it.
Exactly.
I can see your dilemma, Professor. However, both the ancient mysteries and Masonic philosophy celebrate the potentiality of God within each of us. Symbolically speaking, one could claim that anything within reach of an enlightened man is within reach of God.
Langdon felt unswayed by the wordplay.
Even the Bible concurs, Bellamy said. If we accept, as Genesis tells us, that God created man in his own image, then we also must accept what this implies, that mankind was not created inferior to God. In Luke 17:20 we are told, the kingdom of God is within you.
I'm sorry, but I don't know any Christians who consider themselves God's equal.
Of course not, Bellamy said, his tone hardening, because most Christians want it both ways.
They want to be able to proudly declare they are believers in the Bible and yet simply ignore those parts they find too difficult or too inconvenient to believe. Langdon made no response.
Anyhow, Bellamy said, the Masonic Pyramid's age-old description as being tall enough to be touched by God, this has long led to misinterpretations about its size. Conveniently, it keeps academics like yourself insisting the pyramid is a legend, and nobody searches for it.
Langdon looked down at the stone pyramid. I apologize that I'm frustrating you, he said. I've simply always thought of the Masonic Pyramid as a myth.
Does it not seem perfectly fitting to you that a map created by stonemasons would be carved in stone? Throughout history, our most important guideposts have always been carved in stone, including the tablets God gave Moses, 10 commandments to guide our human conduct.
I understand, and yet it is always referred to as the legend of the Masonic Pyramid. Legend implies it is mythical.
Yes, legend, Bellamy chuckled. I'm afraid you're suffering from the same problem Moses had.
I'm sorry? Bellamy looked almost amused as he turned in his seat, glancing up at the second-tier balcony where 16 bronze statues peered down at them.
Do you see Moses?
Langdon gazed up at the library's celebrated statue of Moses.
Yes. He has horns.
I'm aware of that.
But do you know why he has horns?
Like most teachers, Langdon did not enjoy being lectured to. The Moses above them had horns for the same reason thousands of Christian images of Moses had horns, a mistranslation of the Book of Exodus. The original Hebrew text described Moses as having karan or panav, facial skin that glowed with rays of light. But when the Roman Catholic Church created the official Latin translation of the Bible, the translator bungled Moses' description, rendering it as cornuta esset facies sua, meaning his face was horned. From that moment on, artists and sculptors, fearing reprisals if they were not true to the Gospels, began depicting Moses with horns. It was a simple mistake, Langdon replied. A mistranslation by St. Jerome around 400 A.D. Bellamy looked impressed.
Exactly. A mistranslation. And the result is, poor Moses is now misshapen for all history.
Misshapen was a nice way to put it. Langdon, as a child, had been terrified when he saw Michelangelo's diabolical horned Moses, the centerpiece of Rome's Basilica of St. Peter in chains.
I mentioned the horned Moses, Bellamy now said, to illustrate how a single word misunderstood can rewrite history.
You're preaching to the choir, Langdon thought, having learned the lesson firsthand in Paris a number of years back. Sang Greal, Holy Grail. Sang Real, Royal Blood.
In the case of the Masonic Pyramid, Bellamy continued, people heard whispers about a legend, and the idea stuck. The legend of the Masonic Pyramid sounded like a myth. But the word legend was referring to something else. It had been misconstrued, much like the word talisman. He smiled. Language can be very adept at hiding the truth.
That's true, but you're losing me here.
Robert, the Masonic Pyramid is a map. And like every map, it has a legend, a key that tells you how to read it.
Bellamy took the cube-shaped package and held it up.
Don't you see? This capstone is the legend to the pyramid. It is the key that tells you how to read the most powerful artifact on earth, a map that unveils the hiding place of mankind's greatest treasure, the lost wisdom of the ages.
Langdon fell silent.
I humbly submit, Bellamy said, that your towering Masonic pyramid is only this, a modest stone whose golden capstone reaches high enough to be touched by God, high enough that an enlightened man can reach down and touch it.
Silence hung between the two men for several seconds. Langdon felt an unexpected pulse of excitement as he looked down at the pyramid, seeing it in a new light. His eyes moved again to the Masonic cipher. But this code, it seems so
simple.
Langdon nodded. Almost anyone could decipher this. Bellamy smiled and retrieved a pencil and paper for Langdon.
Then perhaps you should enlighten us?
Langdon felt uneasy about reading the code, and yet considering the circumstances it seemed a minor betrayal of Peter's trust. Moreover, whatever the engraving said, he could not imagine that it unveiled a secret hiding place of anything at all, much less that of one of history's greatest treasures. Langdon accepted the pencil from Bellamy and tapped it on his chin as he studied the cipher. The code was so simple that he barely needed pencil and paper. Even so, he wanted to ensure he made no mistakes, and so he dutifully put pencil to paper and wrote down the most common decryption key for a Masonic cipher. The key consisted of four grids, two plain and two dotted, with the alphabet running through them in order. Each letter of the alphabet was now positioned inside a uniquely shaped enclosure, or pen. The shape of each letter's enclosure became the symbol for that letter. The scheme was so simple, it was almost infantile. Langdon double-checked his handiwork. Feeling confident the decryption key was correct, he now turned his attention back to the code inscribed on the pyramid. To decipher it, all he had to do was to find the matching shape on his decryption key and write down the letter inside it. The first character on the pyramid looked like a down arrow or a chalice. Langdon quickly found the chalice-shaped segment on the decryption key. It was located in the lower left-hand corner and enclosed the letter S. Langdon wrote down S. The next symbol on the pyramid was a dotted square, missing its right side. That shape on the decryption grid enclosed the letter O. He wrote down O. The third symbol was a simple square, which enclosed the letter E. Langdon wrote down E. S-O-E. He continued, picking up speed, until he had completed the entire grid. Now, as he gazed down at his finished translation, Langdon let out a puzzled sigh. Hardly what I'd call a eureka moment. Bellamy's face showed the hint of a smile.
As you know, Professor, the ancient mysteries are reserved only for the truly enlightened.
Right, Langdon said, frowning. Apparently, I don't qualify. Chapter 50. In a basement office deep inside CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, the same 16-character Masonic cipher glowed brightly on a high-definition computer monitor. Senior OS analyst Nola Kay sat alone and studied the image that had been emailed to her 10 minutes ago by her boss, Director Inoue Sato. Is this some kind of joke? Nola knew it was not, of course. Director Sato had no sense of humor, and the events of tonight were anything but a joking matter. Nola's high-level clearance within the CIA's all-seeing Office of Security had opened her eyes to the shadow worlds of power. But what Nola had witnessed in the last 24 hours had changed her impressions forever of the secrets that powerful men kept.
"Yes, Director,"
Nola now said, cradling the phone on her shoulder as she talked to Sato.
"The engraving is indeed the Masonic cipher. However, the clear text is meaningless. It appears to be a grid of random letters."
She gazed down at her decryption.
"It must say something,"
Sato insisted.
"Not unless it has a second layer of encryption that I'm not aware of."
"Any guesses?"
Sato asked.
"It's a grid-based matrix, so I could run the usual vignette, grills, trellises, and so forth. But no promises, especially if it's a one-time pad."
"Do what you can, and do it fast. How about the X-ray?"
Nola swiveled her chair to a second system, which displayed a standard security X-ray of someone's bag. Sato had requested information on what appeared to be a small pyramid inside a cube-shaped box. Normally, a 2-inch-tall object would not be an issue of national security unless it was made of enriched plutonium. This one was not. It was made of something almost equally startling.
"Image density analysis was conclusive," Nola said. 19.3 grams per cubic centimeter. It's pure gold. Very, very valuable."
"Anything else?"
"Actually, yes. The density scan picked up minor irregularities on the surface of the gold pyramid. It turns out the gold is engraved with text."
"Really?"
Sato sounded hopeful.
"What does it say?"
"I can't tell yet. The inscription is extremely faint. I'm trying to enhance with filters, but the resolution on the X-ray is not great."
"Okay, keep trying. Call me when you have something."
"Yes, ma'am."
"And Nola?"
Sato's tone turned ominous.
"As with everything you have learned in the last 24 hours, The images of the stone pyramid and gold capstone are classified at the highest levels of security. You are to consult no one. You report to me directly. I want to make sure that is clear.
Of course, ma'am.
Good. Keep me posted.
Sato hung up. Nola rubbed her eyes and looked blearily back at her computer screens. She had not slept in over 36 hours, and she knew damn well she would not sleep again until this crisis had reached its conclusion. Whatever that may be. Back at the Capitol Visitor Center, four black-clad CIA field-op specialists stood at the entrance to the tunnel, peering hungrily down the dimly lit shaft, like a pack of dogs eager for the hunt. Sato approached, having just hung up from a call.
"Gentlemen," she said, still holding the architect's key, "are your mission parameters clear?"
"Affirmative," the lead agent replied. "We have two targets. The first is an engraved stone pyramid, approximately 1 foot tall. The second is a smaller cube-shaped package, approximately 2 inches tall. Both were last seen in Robert Langdon's shoulder bag."
"Correct,"
Sato said.
"These two items must be retrieved quickly and intact. Do you have any questions?"
"Parameters for use of force?" Sato's shoulder was still throbbing from where Bellamy had struck her with a bone.
"As I said, it is of critical importance that these items be retrieved."
"Understood." The four men turned and headed into the darkness of the tunnel. Sato lit a cigarette and watched them disappear. Chapter 51. Catherine Solomon had always been a prudent driver, but now she was pushing her Volvo at over 90 as she fled blindly up the Suitland Parkway. Her trembling foot had been lodged on the accelerator for a full mile before her panic began to lift. She now realized her uncontrollable shivering was no longer solely from fear. "I'm freezing." The wintry night air was gushing through her shattered window, buffeting her body like an arctic wind. Her stockinged feet were numb, and she reached down for her spare pair of shoes, which she kept beneath the passenger seat. As she did, she felt a stab of pain from the bruise on her throat, where the powerful hand had latched onto her neck. The man who had smashed through her window bore no resemblance to the blonde-haired gentleman whom Catherine knew as Dr. Christopher Abaddon. His thick hair and smooth, tanned complexion had disappeared. His shaved head, bare chest, and makeup-smeared face had been unveiled as a terrifying tapestry of tattoos. She heard his voice again, whispering to her in the howl of wind outside her broken window. "Catherine, I should have killed you years ago, the night I killed your mother." Catherine shivered, feeling no doubt. That was him. She had never forgotten the look of fiendish violence in his eyes, nor had she ever forgotten the sound of her brother's single gunshot, which had killed this man, propelling him off a high ledge into the frozen river below, where he plummeted through the ice and never resurfaced. Investigators had searched for weeks, never finding his body, and finally decided it had been washed away by the current out to the Chesapeake Bay. They were wrong, she now knew. He is still alive, and he's back. Catherine felt angst-ridden as the memories flooded back. It was almost exactly 10 years ago, Christmas Day. Catherine, Peter, and their mother, her entire family, were gathered at their sprawling stone mansion in Potomac, nestled on a 200-acre wooded estate with its own river running through it. As was tradition, their mother worked diligently in the kitchen, rejoicing in the holiday custom of cooking for her two children. Even at 75 years of age, Isabel Solomon was an exuberant cook, and tonight the mouth-watering smells of roast venison, parsnip gravy, and garlic mashed potatoes wafted through the house. While mother prepared the feast, Catherine and her brother relaxed in the conservatory, discussing Catherine's latest fascination, a new field called noetic science, an unlikely fusion of modern particle physics and ancient mysticism. Noetics had absolutely captivated Catherine's imagination. Physics meets philosophy. Catherine told Peter about some of the experiments she was dreaming up, and she could see in his eyes that he was intrigued. Catherine felt particularly pleased to give her brother something positive to think about this Christmas, since the holiday had also become a painful reminder of a terrible tragedy. Peter's son, Zachary. Catherine's nephew's 21st birthday had been his last.
The family had been through a nightmare, and it seemed that her brother was only now, finally, learning how to laugh again. Zachary had been a late bloomer, frail and awkward, a rebellious and angry teenager. Despite his deeply loving and privileged upbringing, the boy seemed determined to detach himself from the Solomon establishment. He was kicked out of prep school, partied hard with the celebrati, and shunned his parents' exhaustive attempts to provide him firm and loving guidance. He broke Peter's heart. Shortly before Zachary's 18th birthday, Catherine had sat down with her mother and brother and listened to them debating whether or not to withhold Zachary's inheritance until he was more mature. The Solomon inheritance, a centuries-old tradition in the family, bequeathed a staggeringly generous piece of the Solomon wealth to every Solomon child on his or her 18th birthday. The Solomons believed that an inheritance was more helpful at the beginning of someone's life than at the end. Moreover, placing large pieces of the Solomon fortune in the hands of eager young descendants had been the key to growing the family's dynastic wealth. In this case, however, Catherine's mother argued that it was dangerous to give Peter's troubled son such a large sum of money. Peter disagreed. "The Solomon inheritance," her brother had said, "is a family tradition that should not be broken. This money may well force Zachary to be more responsible." Sadly, her brother had been wrong. The moment Zachary received the money, he broke from the family, disappearing from the house without taking any of his belongings. He surfaced a few months later in the tabloids, trust fund playboy living European high life. The tabloids took joy in documenting Zachary's spoiled life of debauchery. The photos of wild parties on yachts and drunken disco stupors were hard for the Solomons to take. But the photos of their wayward teen turned from tragic to frightening when the papers reported Zachary had been caught carrying cocaine across a border in Eastern Europe. Solomon millionaire in Turkish prison. The prison, they learned, was called Sogunluk, a brutal F-class detention center located in the Kartal district outside of Istanbul. Peter Solomon, fearing for his son's safety, flew to Turkey to retrieve him. Catherine's distraught brother returned empty-handed, having been forbidden even to visit with Zachary. The only promising news was that Solomon's influential contacts at the U.S. State Department were working on getting him extradited as quickly as possible. 2 days later, however, Peter received a horrifying international phone call. The next morning, headlines blared. Solomon heir, murdered in prison. The prison photos were horrific, and the media callously aired them all, even long after the Solomon's private burial ceremony. Peter's wife never forgave him for failing to free Zachary, and their marriage came to an end 6 months later. Peter had been alone ever since. It was years later that Catherine, Peter, and their mother Isabel were gathered quietly for Christmas. The pain was still a presence in their family, but mercifully it was fading with each passing year. The pleasant rattle of pots and pans now echoed from the kitchen as their mother prepared the traditional feast. Out in the conservatory, Peter and Catherine were enjoying a baked brie and relaxed holiday conversation. Then came an utterly unexpected sound.
"Hello, Solomons,"
an airy voice said behind them. Startled, Catherine and her brother spun to see an enormous muscular figure stepping into the conservatory. He wore a black ski mask that covered all of his face except his eyes, which shone with feral ferocity. Peter was on his feet in an instant.
"Who are you? How did you get in here?"
"I knew your little boy Zachary in prison. He told me where this key was hidden."
The stranger held up an old key and grinned like a beast.
"Right before I bludgeoned him to death."
Peter's mouth fell open. A pistol appeared, aimed directly at Peter's chest.
"Sit."
Peter fell back into his chair. As the man moved into the room, Catherine was frozen in place. Behind his mask, the man's eyes were wild like those of a rabid animal.
"Hey!"
Peter yelled, as if trying to warn their mother in the kitchen.
"Whoever you are, take what you want and get out."
The man leveled his gun at Peter's chest.
"And what is it you think I want?"
"Just tell me how much," Solomon said. "We don't have money in the house, but I can—"
The monster laughed.
"Do not insult me. I have not come for money. I have come tonight for Zachary's other birthright."
He grinned.
"He told me about the pyramid."
pyramid, Catherine thought in bewildered terror. What pyramid? Her brother was defiant.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Don't play dumb with me. Zachary told me what you keep in your study vault. I want it.